Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Tuesday, July 16th. This morning, we talk innovation on the battlefield. Need a part for that missile launcher? Water system on your warship on the fritz? Replace that faulty part sooner than later. Days, not months. We also talk about innovation in medical research. We look at gene editing and how University of Hawaii scientists believe their discovery can fix a faulty gene. Both look at creating solutions that are faster, cheaper, and more efficient. We also take a closer look at Shift and Save. It's a pilot project under Hawaiian Electric Company's cheaper day rates and more expensive night rates. What now? And campaign spending gets family-friendly. Childcare is now okay under the rules. And feral cats, how can we stop arguing over what to do with them? This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Spare parts aren't always easy to come by, whether you're in the middle of the ocean or on a battlefield. Today, we look at technology that is being tested out during the military's RIMPAC exercises. It's in use in the battle in Ukraine. And as we speak, a Navy ship of Oahu is testing out a 3D printer on board. It's working on a replacement part to fix its faulty water system. We're talking high-tech solutions to fix a supply chain problem. We were out to see firsthand how this Australian technology is creating stainless steel parts and how postgraduate naval students from Monterey are getting familiar with these advances. Here's Lieutenant Daniel Lukak describing the process called XP3D. It uses powdered metal and a cold spray process to build a spare part from the ground up.
And once we find a part, we can do a 3D scan of it. We build a little bit more material than it needs so that we can end up printing it. And then we have to do a heat treatment process. And then ultimately, we machine it down to exactly what we want. Something I was very interested in, like not only can we do 3D plastic printing, which has been a hot topic lately, but just the fact that we can do a bunch of 3D metal printing in order to build parts is super useful.
We also hear from Patrick Tucker, who's with Fleetworks, a company that is working with the Naval Postgraduate School in California. He says the printers are hard at work servicing all the armed services. Some were large, the size of a shipping container. Others were tabletop size.
The Coast Guard had identified parts to us, two of those that we printed, numerous submarine parts. We've had one part from Naval Special Warfare. For the Marine Corps, we've got the Nemesis, which is a new missile launcher, and we're working on parts for that, which is a big deal because that's the biggest weapon system in the Marine Corps now, the new weapon system, and we've worked on that.
And so describe the scenario out there with the problem with the osmosis system.
Yeah, on the USS Somerset, they've had a part that's failed two times. I think they have two or three reverse osmosis systems, and as a result of not having that part, they may even have to turn off fresh water during shower periods, etc. So if we repair that, then they'll have more flexibility ensuring the reverse osmosis machines they have work.
And so this is fairly new technology that we're rolling out, say, on a battlefield, and it's a nod to the innovation that's out there.
And we're echeloning it too. Like, one of the innovations is actually a float. It doesn't print as fast as this one, but that way you have at the point of need, but then you echelon back to near capability. Like, this is a lot closer than Pennsylvania, where a lot of the manufacturers are. So they're out here floating around. And so we have echelon concept here. And we're actually even trying to print that part up at 25th ID in Schofield as well, because we want to make sure we get it right one way or the other. And so I think the one afloat will be right, but we're actually going to task this printer and then the ones up in Schofield as well.
And so what can you tell us about the parts that may be needed, that need to be waterproof, you know, to put in the ocean?
What we know is that frequently the production here is just as good or better. It just has to be qualified and put in perspective. So the notion that we can't produce a part that's just as good as the old methods is largely incorrect. but we're needing to prove that. We understand that, and that's why we hired Bayer and Conioli to help us with that.
Are there other systems that you're testing out that require AI? I mean, I don't know.
AI is the next step. So in the future, naval postgraduate exercises, we want to have AI to where the production network decisions, like we've got printers that we actually reached back to in Monterey and in Albany, Georgia, too. The AI already looks at that part and figures out which of the printing capabilities is most likely to succeed with that part and just tasks that machine without us being involved in the first place. So that's the new exercise thought about AI's interaction with these computers or these printers.
So it can detect what's needed and then fulfill the order.
It can look at it and then think about what that printer's capabilities were in relation to the part it was needed and see what's the best optimal solution.
And then what is it that excites you when you do these drills out here in a scenario out on the ocean?
Well, as a retired Marine logistician, I frequently saw our assets that were out here in exercise get deadlined, and we had no way to have a response that was adequate. This gives you a potential for success to repair on spot. So for me, it's a big deal, because I did a lot of Pacific exercise and I saw a lot of our assets go deadline and we couldn't get them fixed on site. This is an opportunity to do that.
What about in a situation where these units need to be mobile? You know, if you're out on the front pushing into, past some lines.
Like the machine that we have on the ship represents that, because it's half this size and so it's much more mobile. And then this is still expeditionary because it's all in one 20-footer, but it is more difficult to move, you're right. So if I'm far forward in the foxhole, I may only have a 10-footer capability. We have one of those. And then my reach back to the most local forward operating base, let's say, would be something like this.
Anything else that you're excited to see happen out here?
I think the other part is that we went for efficiency so long with DOD industry that it's really a brittle industry now. And so we need this in the expeditionary environment, but we need this back in continental United States to augment the industrial supply chains that are so brittle at this point. In Ukraine, what happened is so many different weapon systems are being provided by so many different nations. It inferred that you're going to have to use all of those different supply chains. And so AM is perfect for that environment, because here I have a one-stop shop to try to solve multiple supply chain problems that are being fed to the Ukrainians.
That was Patrick Tucker, who was working with the Naval postgraduate students to test out what is called new XP3D printing technology. The 3D machines can make parts in hours or days instead of months. It is being tested during the military's international RIMPAC exercises now underway in the islands. From research out on the battlefield to research in the medical field, building on a breakthrough, the University of Hawaii's Institute for Biogenesis Research was born out of the glow-in-the-dark mice dating back to 2019. And before that, Kumalina, the first clone mouse. And it's thanks to work in genetics inside the laboratory of the late Ryuzu Yanagihara. Now there's news of another potential game-changing discovery that could accelerate fixing faulty genes. Gene editing and the CRISPR technique burst out on the scene a decade ago thanks to Nobel Prize researcher Jennifer Doudna, who was nurtured at Hilo High School. Well, another alum from that same public school has just published a study that UH says could turbocharge how we treat diseases faster and safer. Jesse Owens is an assistant professor at the UH Institute for Biogenesis Research. His work was just published in the journal Nucleic Acids Research. He joined us this morning in studio to explain how his groundbreaking research could lead to treatments that are faster, cheaper, and more efficient.
If you think of somebody who has a disorder, some people might have one mutation and another person might have another mutation. And so if we want to treat two different people, kind of the common way of doing genome editing is we'd have to go into one person change their specific mutation, go into the other person, change their other specific mutation, and you'd have to make a different therapy for each and every single person, which would be a lot of work and a lot of money and a lot of time. So what we're trying to do is we just take a whole copy of your gene that's broken and we bring in a new copy. So it doesn't matter where your old broken copy is. If you have a mutation wherever, it doesn't matter. We just bring in a whole brand new copy. And so that way you could treat any mutation with one single therapy. And the problem is that in order to bring in a large piece of DNA like that, the way that the current methods like CRISPR work is that they don't efficiently bring in large pieces of DNA. So what we've come up with is a more efficient way of bringing in a whole gene. So CRISPR, for example, that is what's really good at knocking genes out. Like, so you can make mutations really easily. So if you've got a gene that you want to get rid of, CRISPR is perfect for that. But when it comes to bringing in a replacement gene, like what I'm talking about, CRISPR's not very good at that in the body. So you can do it in the lab. I can do that in my lab. I've got cells that are dividing, and CRISPR works pretty good in that situation. But when we're talking about the human body, because our cells don't divide very often, the way that CRISPR is used to bring genes in is not very efficient. And so this approach is actually kind of groundbreaking because we're going to be using an active approach for inserting the DNA versus what CRISPR does is kind of a passive approach where it breaks the DNA and then it kind of stands back and lets the cell kind of heal. And that process is not very efficient. So what we're doing is we're actually physically inserting it. And the thing that we work on is actually called an integrase. So it's the perfect name. It's a protein that grabs DNA and actually inserts it. All CRISPR does is it just causes a cut in the DNA.
Okay, so this is less invasive, more gentle.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. There's negatives to doing the CRISPR side of things. I mean, I'm not anti-CRISPR, but I'm just saying that that I'm pointing out our benefits is that when you cause this cut, what people have found over the years is that can be deleterious to the cell. Sometimes the chromosomes can stick to each other, which is bad. Can cause big giant deletions, which is bad. It causes this like emergency response in the cell. And yeah, like you said, ours is like a gentle insertion of the DNA.
I'm, you know, really excited to learn that you went to the same high school as Jennifer Doudna. And so I just, you know, think, gosh, when you see people passionate about their research and they get to a breakthrough, that just must be the most incredible high.
Yeah, well, it's taken us a long time. I think of my other friends that have other jobs where they get the little dopamine hit. Like my friend's an ER doc. And so, you know, he gets a dopamine hit every day. Save person, save person, save person. This took us 4 years to get this paper out. So it's a long build up because there's a lot of failure and there's a lot of optimization and it's very difficult. And you really have to be stubborn in order to get this stuff to work sometimes. The specific thing that we were working on was a very advanced form of evolution that we used to make the protein better. And that in itself is very difficult to optimize. And so that's what took us so long was to get this the system up and running. And a lot of other labs have tried because everybody knows it's a very powerful system, but very few people can get it to work. And at the conference, two different people came up to me and said, I tried to get this to work and we gave up. And I can't believe you guys got it to work. They're like, there's only 5 labs in the whole world that can do this. And I was like, yeah, well, it took us 4 years.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you've had a chance to really chat with Jennifer Doudna about, you know, your research and if she's aware that you're another, you know, Hawaii-grown product here.
I did. She's super nice. I went to public schools benefit that she was at, and I brought the lei so I could break through the crowds.
There you
and
go.
I put it on her head. And I was like, I know how to get into this. And then she wanted to chat. And so it was really nice. Yeah. So we talked a little bit.
When you can build on the work of others, you know, when we had the breakthrough of the glow in the dark mice, right, with Kumalina way back when, and it was just like all that fertility research led to this breakthrough.
Yeah. So I did my PhD at Manoa. And that work was actually doing exactly what you're saying. We were also using integrating enzymes to bring in GFP, which is the glowing gene, into the mice. They're called transgenic mice, or mice that have a new gene inside of them. And that's what I've always been focused on. This kind of work has been my passion since I came up with the idea when I was like 17. And then I went to school to do this, came to Manoa to do the mouse work to try to bring the genes in. And then now what I'm trying to do is bring the genes into people.
talk about the kinds of diseases that maybe this could really have an impact.
Sure. Yeah. So the low-hanging fruit is a recessive disease. So if you have a gene that has a mutation and that gene doesn't work anymore, for example, hemophilia, there's just one gene. If it's mutated, then you have a blood clotting disorder. So you get cut and you just keep bleeding, right? And that's what our grants are funding us to treat. And so what we can do is bring in the hemophilia gene, and there's different ones, but factor 9 is one of them. And then if you express enough of that in your body, you're making enough of the factor. And now when you get cut, you don't bleed to death anymore. So it's just a replacement of a broken gene. It's kind of our main application. But the other applications actually are really interesting. One of them is we can reprogram our immune system to attack cancer. And so when you do that, you got to bring in a gene. It's called CAR-T. And so you got to bring in that gene in order to change the T cell's mind and in order to go get it to go kill the cancer. And so that, again, you need to bring in, you know, because you're bringing in large pieces of DNA, it can use this tool. The other thing that we're actually working on is I just founded a startup out of Manoa. It's a spinoff. And that company is actually going to be, again, bringing in the DNA. But what we're going to be doing is manufacturing antibodies for people. So we're speeding up the process that it takes to make a new antibody. And so like for what happened during COVID was they found the antibodies right away, but it took so long for them to produce the antibodies for people that the disease mutated and they weren't effective anymore. It was a huge problem. So it's kind of a weird thing, but actually if you could just make the antibody faster, like make the treatment faster, people could get it faster. And the other thing is that if you make it faster, it costs less money, because if it takes forever to make it, you're spending a lot of money, right? So it's cheaper for people, and then also they get the treatment quicker. And so that's the whole focus of our little startup that we just came up with a couple months ago.
Wow. And so I can imagine, though, the applications are, gosh, endless. I mean, if you had issues with your eyes, because I believe there's some disease out in the Pacific where, yeah, it, you know.
Yeah, Stargardt's disease is one where you can replace the gene in the eye. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any gene that you can think of that has a mutation could be replaced using this kind of technology. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so when you finally got to the point where you realized that, hey, this technique works, I mean, were you just like jumping for joy?
Yeah. So we were actually really surprised that it works so well. So what we ended up doing is, so like I said, we're using this evolution in order to make this thing work. And what we did was, I should step back. The way that people typically use evolution to make a protein better is very time consuming. So every single cycle of evolution, you've got to make the protein, then you've got to mutate it. And then you got to screen all the different mutants. You got to figure out which mutant was the good one, right? You pull that guy out, and then you got to mutate it again, right? So that's like one cycle, right? So normally that cycle, if you don't have a life, you don't have a girlfriend, you don't have a social life, you can do one cycle in a week, okay, which is pretty fast. So that means you can do like 50 cycles in a year, right? So what we can do in our lab, because we've optimized this new system, is we can do 50 cycles in a day. Whoa. So we can do a year's worth of work in just one day. And so that's what allowed us to really improve upon this protein so much that the efficiency went up so high that we were detecting it working at 80% of the time per chromosome. Now, you're a human, so you got two chromosomes each. So you got two different targets, and you're hitting each target 80% of the time. If you do the math on that, it comes out to hitting the cell 96% of the time. This is record-breaking. There's no other technology that you can use for bringing in large pieces of DNA at that high efficiency.
Wow. I mean, I just think you're going to be like the next rock star in science with this if you can really help, you know, patients that are suffering from these diseases.
You know, the challenge now is also trying to get this DNA or this system into the different cells. And then also it's a long process going through the FDA and all of that stuff. That's actually one of the reasons we went with the path that I just described about the antibody generation, because it's a simpler, easier path. It's not a therapeutic. We're just helping people make antibodies or other things that are similar to antibodies faster. So it was kind of an easier, quicker path to helping people. So yeah. I think that's actually, we don't need to raise as much money.
It's a shortcut, but it's maybe still more direct.
Yeah, it's still good for people.
Yeah. Well,
You know, gosh, so you said that you came up with this when you were 17 years old. I mean,
well, when I was 17, I decided that I wanted to work on inserting DNA into cells or into animals and people. I mean, not this specific.
Right. No, yeah. But I mean, yeah. Obviously you concept, had an interest.
Yeah. Yeah,
in
yeah,
this
yeah, yeah.
area. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you remember where that came from?
You know, people have asked me this before, and honestly, I just think it's really cool. Yeah, that's all I've got. You know, I just think it's really powerful and really just neat. When I discovered what gene therapy was, or, you know, just the idea of bringing in a gene, I was happy working on the mice and making the glowing mice. You know, I made a mouse glow red and green once.
Whoa.
You know, so I mean, I just think it's really fun and really cool stuff. And yeah, it's got a million applications, which doesn't hurt. But I actually really do just enjoy the techniques and improving on it and making it work better. I mean, I didn't think we were actually going to get efficiencies this high in my career. I was kind of shooting for like 40%. And I was going to be really happy. So, you know, now that we've got it up to 80%, I'm pretty stoked.
That was Jesse Owens, assistant professor at the University of Hawaii Institute for Biogenesis Research, talking with us about the new genetic breakthroughs that he's been working on.
Since 2020, runners Josh Kerr and Jakob Ingebrigtsen have traded victories on the track and jabs in the media.
The drama in this goes so deep.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. A fierce rivalry between Britain and Norway heats up Olympic track and field. That story and the day's top global news next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Overnight deliveries are becoming more and more common. So what happens at the airport to make that possible?
Some of them have a different shape because of their different compartments of the aircraft have different shapes. So we literally are maximizing as much of that airframe as we possibly can.
I'm Amy Scott. We take you inside overnight shipping next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6.
Shift and save. For the last 6 months, a number of Hawaiian Electric Company customers have been challenged to change their behavior and get rewarded by saving money. The pilot project to charge higher rates in peak evening hours to discourage usage is ending, or at least the payment protection is ending. Here to talk about that is HPR reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote. Good morning, Savannah.
Yes, good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so a number of people were selected randomly to participate in this.
Yeah, you got that exactly correct. So this is a pilot program. It's a year in total, and 16,000 customers were randomly enrolled on Hawaii Island and Oahu. And initially, this pilot program was supposed to start in 2023 and include Maui as well, but it was pushed back, delayed, and Maui was removed from the random trial because of last year's fires. So now we started in February 2024. We've hit about the halfway mark of this year-long pilot program. And you hit it right on the money. The people who have been in this program for the last 6 months have seen lower rates during the day when solar is abundant and higher rates in the evening and overnight. And theoretically, time of use is a win-win because people who are able to switch their energy usage to the daytime, which is better for the grid, are also able to save some money on their energy bills. But that assumes that folks know that they are enrolled in this pilot program. And I talked to Colin Steinberger, who is a resident of Waialua on Oahu, and he actually found out just a few weeks ago that he was on the new time of use rates. He had missed that original email from HECO informing him that he was part of the program.
If I'm not expecting an email from Hawaiian Electric Company with my bill, for example, then I'm not keeping an eye out for an email from Hawaiian Electric Company. So I didn't even know I was part of the test group. So I had no wherewithal to adjust my energy usage.
Well, you know, it's funny because, full disclosure, I was one of the random people selected. Our household was part of the shift and save. And it's a challenge, you know, trying to find a different time to do your laundry and charge your electric vehicle.
Certainly, you have to make a lot of adjustments in order to really utilize the program. And folks may actually not have seen any changes in their bills so far because of the last 6 months, there's been bill protection in place. So there's been a $10 cap on any bill increases that you would see if you were still using energy primarily in the evening and overnight when it's more expensive. But that ends this month. And so Colin actually found out that he was a part of the time of use program because he got a second email from HECO letting him know that those bill protections were going to go away. And so if he wanted to opt out, if he was concerned about not having bill protection, he would need to do so by the end of July.
Yeah, well, we re-upped. and we have actually managed to save money because of that switch. But it takes a lot of effort, a lot of planning.
Yeah, people certainly can make use of it, and time of use is used in a lot of different states by a lot of different utilities. This is just new for folks in Hawaii, so if you are able to make some adjustments, it could be really valuable. HECO is planning to do a full analysis of these first 6 months of the data from the test group, but that won't be completed until November. And hopefully that'll give us some answers to how many people are opting out of the program, how their energy patterns are changing, and what their bills look like. But I spoke with Michael Angelo. He's the head of the consumer advocate. And he said his office is going to review that data carefully and make recommendations to protect the interests of ratepayers. And here's Michael.
From our office's perspective, one of our big concerns, of course, is that if you're financially constrained and you don't have the resources, or you're on a set work schedule and you have to come home during the evening, cook dinner for your kids, yourself, you're using a lot of your electricity, perhaps during that peak time, whether there is any ability to even change your behavior. And that's one of the things that we would be interested in. And if that is overly impacting certain classes of customers, that's certainly something that we would want to have addressed.
Yeah, it does take time to change your habits.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that leeway, say you work 9 to 5, and so the only time you can come home, shower, cook dinner, do laundry is in those evening hours, it could be really difficult for you. However, if you do have the opportunity during the day to make use of time of use, the Shift and Save program, there could be benefits. And if you want to know for sure, this was something that was advocated both when I talked to Hawaiian Electric and the consumer advocate, you can go to your customer portal on Hawaiian Electric's website. And there's a calculator that allows you to kind of play around with these numbers to look at how much you might save on your bill if you were able to adjust your usage to more energy usage in the daytime, or if you were to keep it the same in the evenings and overnight. And so that is probably the best way for folks to get hard numbers in front of them about whether or not time of use works for their schedule and whether or not they want to opt out or stay with the program.
Well, like I said, we opted in. What's Colin going to do?
You know, Colin, even though he is, a little late to the game in knowing about the program, he says that it's working for him. He had noticed in his energy bills over the last couple of months that they are lower. So he says, at least for now, he's going to stick with it.
Being the curious one in me, I'd say, hey, I'm going to stay in and see if I even needed the protection. Because, like I said, my bills went down. So there's a possibility I'm not in that you need to be protected from a more expensive bill category. And so if that's the case, then yeah, I mean, it fits the lifestyle of the energy usage at my apartment, and it seems to be a benefit.
Yeah, I find that I just have to store up my laundry and then do it on the weekends during the day.
Yeah, whatever system works for you. And ultimately, the consumer advocate said that what they want people to have is choice. So if you can make use of time of use, that's great. If it doesn't work for you, they want people to be able to opt out.
Yeah, well, I'll be curious to see what that final report says, you know, with all the feedback from everybody.
Yeah, and if time of use seems like it has strong support, this is something that could be rolled out generally as soon as 2025.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HVR Savannah Harriman-Pope with an update on a pilot program aimed at changing customers' energy consumption habits. Thank you.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii, presenting funk and soul band Tower of Power, performing songs such as You're Still a Young Man in two sets nightly this Friday and Saturday. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, what happens when a celebrity endorsement goes terribly wrong?
I mean, this is not just a mistake. This is a crime, and this is something horrible.
We dig into one gruesome story.
Industry observers said this is really bad news for Subway.
Your brand's spokesperson just got arrested. Now what? That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Support for HPR comes from the Chamber of Sustainable Commerce with a Honolulu Pauhana Mixer this evening at Inspiration Hawaii Museum, King and Richard Street. Registration at chamberofsustainablecommerce.org.
The Campaign Spending Commission has ruled that campaign funds can be used to pay for childcare expenses. Here to talk about that is HPR's Ashley Mizuo. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, so the Campaign Spending Commission put out an advisory opinion last week that campaign funds can be now used to pay for childcare expenses as long as it's directly related to the candidate's campaign and like influence the nomination of the candidate. So that doesn't mean that you can use it once you're in office. It's only during campaign season. Jeannie Ota, who isn't running for office, had asked the commission for this opinion because she wanted to help those who might want to use their funds for childcare, but were scared of either risking a big fine if it was found that you couldn't do that, or public backlash if it felt like it looked bad or something. And so childcare in Hawaii is very expensive. A recent study by LendingTree showed that Hawaii is the seventh most expensive for parents paying for childcare in comparison to their income. It said parents pay over $1,600 a month in Hawaii for childcare. But this new opinion in Hawaii makes Hawaii now one of 33 states that has explicitly authorized using campaign funds for childcare expenses. You know, the Federal Elections Commission has also issued a similar opinion for candidates running for national office. And that was the reasoning the Hawaii Campaign Spending Commission used to justify this opinion. If it can be done at a federal, why not a local one? Lisa Dugan is with the Vote Mama Foundation, an organization that advocates for caregivers to hold public office. And she says, you know, the inability to afford childcare is a reason why many people, particularly mothers, wait until their children are grown to even consider running for office.
I hope that as we continue to expand and normalize this vital resource, that we anticipate that the number of candidates using campaign funds to cover child care and dependent care expenses will continue to rise because it's so needed. I've heard from many moms in particular who have said, I can't run because of child care, or the only reason why I was able to run was because I could use my campaign funds to pay for child care expenses. I think that we often overlook the time commitment it takes to run a campaign.
And you know, a 2022 study by the Vote Mama Foundation showed that less than 7% of Hawaii state legislatures were mothers with minor children.
Well, I recall, you know, the time when Senator Jill Takuda and then Representative Sylvia Luke became the money chairs.
Right.
And they talked about how they have children at home and they wanted to, you know, hold to deadlines and not be there, you know, past midnight.
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah, it does change the thinking of how things work.
Right. It does change the perspective when you have mothers or fathers with young children and you know, they bring a different perspective to the table. And you see that with those lawmakers. And with this opinion now, is the Vote Mama Foundation says that, you know, it's a step forward in the right direction, but they want to see it codified through legislation because it's much more secure that way. And also during the discussion, the Campaign Spending Commission also suggested passing a law because opinions can only answer the question being asked. So it can't get really as specific as legislation can. For the last 2 years, Senator Donna Mercado Kim has introduced bills that allow the use of campaign funds for not just child care, but also elder and dependent care. So both years, it made it to conference committee, which is one of the very last steps of the legislative process. But the legislation died, even though it had wide support from lawmakers. Senator Kim herself was a single mom. And when I asked her about what it was like when she was campaigning with her son, Micah Ayu, who is now a state representative, when he was young, she said she really relied on her parents' support during that time to watch him.
I could go to work, peace of mind, knowing that he was being well taken care of. Now, a lot of people, friends would tell me, you're so lucky you have your parents here. Because there's a lot of people that don't have their parents. They might be from somewhere else or a neighbor island. You know, my in-laws are from the neighbor island. And I know when my parents would go, they would fly over and help care for my son. But many people don't have that. And then when my mom got really ill, I was help caregiving for her. But I had the resources to be able to handle that. So this bill wasn't effective, probably wouldn't have affected me. But there are so many other people that are not as fortunate as I was.
And, you know, Senator Kim hopes that this opinion will help increase the momentum on this bill and get it past the finish line this upcoming legislative session. The bill also lays out more specific rules on how the funds can be spent, like not being able to use it to pay an immediate family member, for example. You know, one thing that people have really honed in on that I spoke about this with is that parents who currently have kids, as we talked about earlier, they really bring this very specific perspective to the table. I spoke with Becky Gardner, who is a single mom with two school-aged children, and she ran for office in 2020 for District 21, which is currently represented by Representative Jackson Sayama. Her younger daughter is 11 years old, and, you know, public school issues were a focal point of her campaign.
If we wait, then we're wasting so much talent. And then there's like the immediacy of the moment that is gone. I'd have to wait another 7 years before she's graduated from high school. I'm not going to remember a lot of this stuff. It's not going to be as important to me. I'm going to be tired. I'll be 57. You know, like, it's not going to be the same.
Yeah. And so, you know, like with some distance, she says, you know, lawmakers who, even though they have children, you know, if once the children are older, they're not fully immersed in it. They're not sending their kids to public school. They're not, you know, going to school meetings, like navigating school systems, and also dealing with things that, you know, parents are dealing with on a daily basis. And so she's talking about how this like lived experience, you know, brings extra perspective to the table, and that this is just lowering the barrier. This new opinion lowers the barrier for parents to enter campaigns. And, you know, Gardner said she did consider trying to test this and use her campaign funds for childcare when she was running. But she was worried about the stigma that could follow. And she says, you know, it's up to all parents, not just mothers, to normalize it. And that's something that Dugan and Senator Kim mentioned. You know, these caregiving provisions are not just for mothers or for wives or, you know, or for women. They're for fathers, too. And, you know, if they were talking about how if you're a father and you're running for office, like you should use this to, you know, normalize it and, you know, help, you know, give people more security when they decide to use their campaign funds for childcare. And so anyway, if you're a candidate and you're juggling kids with your campaign and you're considering using these campaign funds for childcare, send me an email, get in touch with me. I want to hear from you. Yeah, it's a really interesting story and a really difficult thing to juggle, I think.
Yeah, I just wonder, gosh, why did it take so long for the commission to say, it's all right.
Yeah.
You can use these funds. It's appropriate. You won't get in trouble.
Right, right. And I think some of it's just you have to ask the question and people are scared of backlash of broaching that topic, I think.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens at the next legislative session. But thanks. Thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you.
We've been talking to HBR's Ashley Mizuo. Look for her legislative stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Julianne Nicholson. Proud to call herself a character actor, she's appeared in dozens of films and TV series, from Ally McBeal in Boardwalk Empire to August Osage County in Mare of Easttown, where she earned an Emmy Award. She stars in the new film, Janet Planet. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi,
I'm Mark Nepo, author of You Don't Have to Do It Alone. And next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about friendship as an island of safety.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
What to do about our feral cats? It is a question that we've been grappling with for decades now. Animal welfare professionals and conservation scientists have clashed over culling the colonies using euthanasia or using the TNR technique, which stands for trap, neuter, and release. For the past 5 years, scientists from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, and workers from the Hawaiian Humane Society have found common ground on the feral cat issue. Two members of the group, Kirsten Leong from NOAA and Steph Kendrick from the Humane Society, spoke with the conversation's Maddie Bender. Kendrick starts us off.
I'm fairly new to animal welfare. I've been doing this work now for about 8 years. I spent 25 years as a print journalist in Hawaii. And came to this position initially as our public policy advocate, so really responsible for building grassroots and political support for animal welfare issues. And what I quickly learned was, particularly on the free-roaming cat issue, building that stakeholder group was going to be difficult. There were a lot of attempts made in the past to have these conversations, and they all broke down, usually resulting in some bad feelings on both sides about how things had gone or not gone. And I was running into a lot of resistance from people who were thinking they were just going to have the same conversation that they had, and it hadn't worked last time, so why should they bother talking now? And I was at a conservation conference where one of my co-workers was on the panel, along with a woman named Kirsten Leong. And after Kirsten's presentation, I was just blown away and thought, well, here's someone who's thinking differently about these conflicts, about this issue, and maybe she can help me move this forward. And so we just started talking super informally.
I'm a social scientist with NOAA Fisheries, and I've been working a lot on the ways that people think about animals, the way they think about how we manage animals. And so when I came to NOAA, I was aware that the cat controversy had been going on for a while in conservation circles for actually a number of decades. And when I came to NOAA was just when toxoplasmosis was being sort of identified as one of the top threats to Hawaiian monk seals. And so then NOAA being the agency that manages recovery of monk seals, we knew that we needed to start getting involved in the outdoor cat management conversation, because toxoplasmosis is a disease parasite that is only reproduces in the gut of cats. And we saw that over the years, sort of arguing over what method of managing outdoor cats was really not getting anywhere. It was getting us stuck. It was a conservation impasse. And we wanted to think about things a little bit differently and think about where are ways that we do have common ground and how might we work together to move forward. So we started talking and just gradually moved a little bit slowly. And over the past 5 years, it's kind of coalesced into a working arrangement.
This group got together 5 years ago. What used to be the topics of discussion, and now that it's been 5 years, what do you come together to talk about these days?
I mean, I think for me, the main thing is that, you know, just thinking back to the first meeting, it was a little bit like, what, the fall before COVID. So we were, and we just, I think, Steph, it was because you reached out and said, like, let's all get together. Do you want a tour of our campus? And so we all got together for lunch, you know, and just, I think we were a little bit nervous the first time we all met. Like, how is this going to go? And we had some ground rules. Like, we know that the arguments are over whether lethal control, or we're calling it humane dispatch, you know, I think that's a little more accurate, whether humane dispatch or TNR works. And we said, you know what? We know that's going to activate conversations that aren't going to get us anywhere. So let's just agree that we're not going to try to take either of those off the table, and we're going to try to find space for things we can talk about. And then as we got more comfortable working together and talking together, that's when we branched out. We started understanding where our focus was. We actually are focused on different ends of the outdoor cat spectrum, so to speak, in a way too, where the wildlife conservation professionals are really focused on the cats that are having the greatest impact on wildlife and protected habitats and areas. And the cat welfare community is really focused on those cats that have the relationship with human communities. So realizing even that it's not all the same cats. We can't just say there's one size fits all. That's really what we're trying to get at with this paper, is that these, the TNR versus Humane Dispatch is treating it as if it's a one size fits all solution, and it's not a one size fits all problem. There are all these different, very specific situations that require different combinations of things. And then realizing that collectively, neither of our main core techniques is going to work unless we collectively get a handle on the new cats that are coming into the environment, the pet cats, that they're contributing to this outdoor cat population that would keep either of us, either TNR or Humane Dispatch, in that method forever. And none of us want that. And so how can we provide resources that help pet cat owners, Pono cat parents? And so we learned together. We took some workshops together about how to develop those materials. And then with opportunities like this, with the paper coming out, to just get that word out to the broader public that we are having these conversations, that we're starting to find ways to talk together, and that it really is a community effort.
The papers were a big part of the conversation at first, particularly the currently published paper. And the Pono Cat Parent Pledge was, I think we all had a real sense of accomplishment once we went through that process. So it's hosted on the website of the Hawaii Veterinary Medical Association. We wanted it to be sort of a neutral party that is respected both by scientists and by pet owners. It's really a list of six tenets that are designed to encourage cat owners to take steps that both improve the health and well-being of their cat and protect the environment. And it's pretty common sense stuff. You know, keep your cat indoors or confined in a leash or carrier if you want to take them outdoors. I have a lot of colleagues who've leash trained their cats. They have a wonderful time outside without being a threat to any wildlife. You know, dispose of your litter appropriately so that it's not going into our water system. It's nothing that's hard for folks to do. It's about creating an enriching environment for your cat so that they have all the stimulation they need inside. But if everybody who cares about cats were to take a look at this and commit to those actions, it would make a huge improvement in our community.
And when you're thinking about ways in which this group has succeeded in having this conversation when in the past such dialogue has failed, acknowledging there is a debate and not trying to win, like almost taking the meta approach to talk about what it means that there's a debate, that seems big.
Yeah, I think that was a big aha that was actually, you know, a lot of it stemmed from even often when we approach value differences and we don't necessarily realize their value differences. And so we try to argue for the logic of the way that we're looking at the issue. And so sort of, as you said, if we take a step back and try to take a more meta approach and think about how are we talking about what we're trying to do, that was what led us to really realize we're only seeing a little piece of the system. And so for each of us, if we're looking at an outdoor cat and we're thinking about them as a different, literally different animal, an invasive species or a homeless pet, then the techniques that you use are going to be different depending on your discipline. So if you're looking at an invasive species, you know, there are ways that as a society we think about dealing with pests. Whereas if you're trying to solve a problem related to homeless pet overpopulation, dispatch, regardless of how humane it is just not an appropriate approach. And so that's where reproductive control is one that would make sense if that's the problem that you're trying to solve. And so that's where it was getting really entrenched of arguing about these things, but not realizing that the whole time we have this dripping tap, that's the turn off the tap analogy of these new pet cats that are being added to the environment.
I also think the relationships building in and of itself has been super important, and learning that we all care about all of the animals. I mean, there's not anyone in animal welfare who doesn't care about monk seals and our native birds. And I happen to know that several people on the conservation side are passionate cat lovers. So just getting to know that about each other, that we're all coming to this from a place of we want to do what's best for the animals. And also realizing that just breaking down along the same fault lines isn't helping move that forward either. So even if we can't make as much progress as quickly as any of us would like on solving some of these issues, how do we at least keep the conversation going so we're moving in the right direction? And I've seen just a real sea change in kind of the respect for each other and a temperature drop in terms of the rhetoric that both sides are using. You know, to be honest, there's a lot of people on the animal welfare side, for example, who want to tell you that toxoplasmosis isn't a problem. And if it is a problem, cats aren't involved. Well, that's not the science. That's not the scientific reality. So we need to acknowledge that toxoplasmosis is a terrible parasite that is fiercely successful at living in the environment. And it is a concern that we need to address. And similarly, on the conservation side, you know, I think nobody wants to see vigilantes taking matters into their own hands, because we've talked about what a threat cats are. And I know that none of my conservation partners want to see that.
What's on your plate going forward? And is now the time finally for a compromise to finally make some inroads? And what would that look like?
I can speak to that, since I am a paid lobbyist and Kirsten isn't. We have a diverse group that's involved in this. So there are some members from the conservation agencies who do public policy work as part of their role. And so I am looking forward to working with them on ideas for next session, and they have their own as well. But one of the things that we've talked about collaborating on the past is funding for better science around free roaming cats across the state. So money for a census so that we get a better look at what the population really is, and more importantly, from a conservation perspective, probably where it is and where it's closer to areas that are sensitive wildlife habitat. So that's one of the areas that we've talked about collaborating on. We don't have any firm plans yet for next session, but I think that will be a part of our meetings in the next few months and more to come.
I'm sure we're going to have a lot of people who are passionate on, you know, all different sides of this discussion, ways they can get involved, or ways maybe the next time before they post that comment to Reddit or send an email to their local public radio station should think about how to engage in civil discourse on this topic.
I would just say, as an advocate, you know, be respectful. The cat issue is complicated and it stirs passions, but it's not the only issue out there that does. And I've never seen anyone change their mind about something because someone was rude or mean to them. So if you really want to help on this issue, learn so that you can speak knowledgeably and be respectful, even with people you disagree with.
If people are really calling for either or, it's this or that, you're either with us or against us, that's kind of a signal that it's probably more complex than that. And really start digging into and thinking about, what is the driver? It might not be the same as yours. And so really trying to, again, understand, where are other people coming from? Is there space that you can both, you know, work together, and what would it take to find that space? Because trying to educate someone out of each other's values just doesn't work. And so rather than doing that, just trying to understand, what is the value system they're coming from, and, you know, where are these opportunities to learn together?
That was NOAA's Kristen Leong and Steph Kendrick, who's with the Hawaiian Humane Society. They were talking with HVR's Maddie Bender. We will share links to their paper as well as to the Pono Cat Parent Pledge on the conversation page of our website after the show. That wraps it up for us today. Tomorrow, we will have a call-in show on the state of Hawaii's economy. Yunji Denise sits in while I take a few days off. Share your comments or questions about what you've heard on our show by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.